let you know, Kate...
Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Kate Georgian and Angela Webster from Tennessee have joined.
Hello. Thank you. Welcome. We still got a couple more people coming on, so I want to make sure everybody's...
We should probably get started, Teresa.
Okay. Welcome, everyone, to our third conference call of 2010 from the National Technical Assistance Center in Voting and Cognitive Access. We also call ourselves NTAC. My name is Teresa Moore, and I will be the facilitator today. The title of the call is Accessible Voting Materials. This will last about 1 hour and a half, and these proceedings will be recorded for future use. I want to ask all of the listeners to please mute their telephones, to limit distractions, and to mute your phone. You press star 6 on your phone now if you'd like, and there may be some beeping that you hear on your end. If you want to ask a question later, all you have to do is press star 6 again. I'd like to welcome our listeners who have joined us for this call. There's over 24 locations that have registered for this call. We are happy to have all of you here. We are joined today by speakers who will share their ideas and experiences about creating accessible information. Our guest speakers today are Julie Anderson, an attorney with disability rights in Oregon, Hannah Bowen, co-director of NTAC, Sakina McWright, the project coordinator for Money Follows the Person project in Washington, D.C., and Lynn Tamer, president of ArcLink Incorporated, and Nancy Ward, the other co-director of the NTAC project and a leader in the self-advocacy movement. After I introduce each caller, our speakers will answer a series of questions from me, and then we will have to make time for each of our listeners, if they would, any of our listeners, to have a time to answer questions. Just for your information, at the SAVE conference last week, the Project Vote team videotaped interviews with 21 self-advocates about their experience as voters. One of the questions asked was, do you think voting information is easy or hard to understand? While some people were interviewed had been voting for 20 years, 30 years, or more, most of the voters still said overwhelmingly that the information was too hard to understand. They talked about the problems with knowing the basics of how to vote, as well as the problems they had researching the issues and candidates. Let's face it, voting information is hard to understand, and thanks to misleading ads and confusing ballot measures and knowing what you want to vote on the issues, it can really be confusing. If it doesn't matter if you have a disability or not, people are struggling with information. Technology is growing in leaps and bounds, and the more and more options are creating accessible materials exist. But it still can be difficult to know what to do and how to do it. And the conference call today, we hope to talk with different groups and have them tell us how they went about making information accessible all across the country. First up, I'd like to introduce Julie and Hannah. And, again, Julie is an attorney with Oregon's PNA since 2003. She has worked with the PAVA issues ranging from helping design Oregon's unique electronic voting system to helping create accessible language voting guides And Hannah, again, is the co-director of NTAC and has a long history of helping self-advocates with voting issues. She works diligently with the team to make sure that our information is accessible. First off, I'd like to ask Julie and Hannah to tell us about the project that you work on together and what its history is of the guide.
Okay, well, thank you, Teresa. This is Julie. And Hannah and I work together on what's called an easy voting guide in Oregon. And the history of this is that I used to actually create my own guide with a team of people each election, and it was a nightmare, and I won't even go into why it was a nightmare, but it was. And eventually I teamed up with the League of Women Voters and a literacy group in 2005 and began working on a project that they already had going and worked on adapting that. And then Hannah joined the team in November 2008.
Okay. So that's where it all began, kind of a personal interest that developed into something that could be useful for everyone. Tell us about the process you go through to create the guide.
Go and you can chime in whenever, okay?
Thanks, Julie.
Okay. Well, basically, we have project partners, and a very important project partner is the local League of Women Voters Education Fund, and they actually research each of our ballot measures that we have, and they get all the background that's necessary about what the ballot measures will do if passed, and they talk to both sides of the measures, or many times there's more than two sides, there's lots of sides. They talk to the supporters and the people who are opposing the measures. And they eventually produce a draft that they use for what they call their standard voting guide, because they produce a guide that's not meant for low literacy readers as the Easy Voter Guide is. They then send that draft to me, and I take a first stab at making it, converting it into accessible language, and then I send that on to Hannah and another one of our partners, Marcy Tedlow, who works with self-advocates as leaders. Together, the three of us make up the literacy team, and we try to create accessible language for the ballot measures. As far as the candidates go, I write a letter that tells candidates how to write in accessible language, gives them some examples, gives them some ideas, some tools to use. Some of them use those, some of them don't. And then we ask them to just identify their top three issues that they want to work on if they're elected. And we do not edit anything that they send to us. We use their spelling, their punctuation, their everything. The reason for that is that you can run afoul of FEC rules if you start messing with their language, so we don't. And we put that into the guide to let readers know that, you know, the candidates chose their own words and punctuation and stuff. There's also graphics that get developed, and the process for that, and the graphics are to go with the ballot measures to help people understand what the measures are about. And there's two per ballot measure. We work with a really great artist, and typically he develops a set of ideas about, for example, we have one coming up on creating medical marijuana dispensaries or stores here in Oregon. And so he develops ideas about, well, what if I show a marijuana leaf with the words RX for prescription, and then the second icon being a building with a marijuana leaf and an RX on it. And we give him feedback, yeah, that sounds great, and then, you know, he develops them and we approve them. And so that's kind of the process that goes on. And once we get it all together, the literacy team does get, this took some doing, but we do get the final edit on all the printed material. That's important because in the past we would think things were done and then there'd be changes made after we had a final look. And in fact, I go to the printer's office and I sit in on the layout sessions to make sure that things are the way that we want them. So, Hannah?
I really feel like the partnership is really key there. It's nice to have so many people involved in putting together a guide like this. Having the league do some of that initial research and gathering that information is it's so helpful. And then having the three of us, Marcy and me from our self-advocacy group, from Self-Advocates as Leaders, and Julie from the PNA there, be able to throw ideas off of each other for what language works and what language doesn't. And then, you know, we'll pull in other people, like on the one that we were just working on, there were several words that I was getting stuck on, and I called Nancy to help to figure out what words would work better in the situation.
Was that Self-Advocates that you called?
Yeah.
To help you with that? To help you break those down or make it clear?
Yeah, because sometimes I'm not sure if the words, I've got a lot of experience with creating easy-to-read materials, but sometimes I'm not really sure if what I'm writing is really accessible, and it really helps to run it by someone with a disability that you know who you know is going to be able to tell if this is something that they understand and they think that other people with disabilities will understand.
You know, and Teresa, I just wanted to add to that. I know you're going to ask us later on about the role of self-advocates in this, but I think it's really, really crucial. Very early on, the guide that was being produced when I first became involved, it wasn't meant for self-advocates. It was meant for adult education learners, people who spoke English as a second language, different population. And so one of the first things I did was put together focus groups of self-advocates, and we spent the day, well, not the day, but several hours going through the guide and getting feedback, getting ideas, and that was invaluable. Some of the things were, you know, gee, we'd sure like to see photos of the candidates, and like, oh yeah, that'd be great, you know. We'd like a table of contents so we know how to find things easier, and just some simple things like that, and ongoing feedback. Every single election, I go out and do outreach to the self-advocate community, and I team up with Marcy to do that. And what I do is I take the guide around. That's part of the workshop, and we go through it, and I listen to people's information, and you know, I see what they're understanding, what they're not. I'll give you an example. One of the things that we were running into is people not being sure when they were registering to vote for the first time what party they should select, and not knowing enough information about the parties. So one of the things we added to the guide was platform statements from each of the registered parties, political parties in Oregon, so that people can look at that and see, you know, which party matches their values most closely. And so really, I mean, for me, the self-advocates are you know, invaluable partners in this, because that's who I have in mind when I'm working on this.
You mentioned the formats of some of the guides that it used to be available in. What formats is it available in for the Easy Voting Guide?
It's printed in large print, large font, and it's posted online, PDF and text for screen readers. It's also MP3 online, and you can order an audio CD. It's also available in Spanish. There were plans to make it available in some other languages online. That fell through due to funding, but we are hoping in the future to pursue that.
So you stated that you get information from the candidates. How hard is that to get them involved in doing this? And do you give them information to try to help them make things a little more clear for people?
Yeah, and again, I no longer contact the candidates. That's the League of Women Voter Volunteers to do that now. But what I do is I write a letter to them that tells them why it's important that their materials be in accessible language, and then I give them ideas about how to do it, and examples of those ideas. I tell them, for example, to use shorter sentences with only one idea per sentence. I talk to them about choosing words that are more common words. So, for example, using the word job instead of employment, and just some simple things like that. And then I give them some tools about how they can check to see what their readability is. Some candidates have really taken this to heart and do a good job of you know, trying to present information in accessible ways. There are other candidates who refuse, sometimes on purpose, quite frankly, to do so. And there's not a lot we can do about that because we are not allowed to change their language. So
visually, what does the guide look like a little bit when you it now has graphics and pictures? Frame for us what a basic page might look like or the guide looks like for people.
I sure will. There's three parts to the guide, and one is just kind of general information. It tells you about the election, for example, if it's a primary or a general, and it tells a little bit about what that means and what offices are being voted on. There's a section that has some parts of our Voter Bill of Rights from Oregon, the most important part. It talks about how you can register to vote, how you fill out a ballot. In Oregon, we vote by mail, and that's confusing to some people, so we have a section on that. We talk about the tools that are available in Oregon for people with disabilities, and we talk about why you should vote, you know, that it's your chance to use your voice. And then it gets into the two main sections, which are the ballot measures and the candidates. The candidates are each time there's a new position, like senator, there's a short description of what that office is, and those are written by the literacy team. For example, I'll read you the one for the senator. It says that a U.S. senator represents people from all of Oregon in the U.S. Senate. They help make laws that affect the whole country. They vote on budget and taxes for the whole country. There are two senators from Oregon. This job lasts 6 years, then the voters choose again. So it gives people a little bit of an idea about, you know, what the office is they're voting on. And then each candidate who responds, there's a picture of them. There's a it tells their party, what town they live in, what their job and experience are, and then the top three things they want to do if they win. And they list those three things, and then they also choose from a library of pictures, of icons, they choose three icons that go with the text that they're using. So that's the way it is for all the candidates. And then at the ballot measures, I'm flipping through. I'm actually looking at one right now. We list the ballot measure, and we put the title of the ballot measure in accessible language, but then we also list the official title. And the reason we do that is that official title is what's going to be on their ballot, so the person will be able to recognize it from that. There's a little icon that shows if it's a ballot measure that will create a new statute or if it will change our Constitution. And there's a section in the guide that tells them about that and what the differences are. And so there's an icon to show, hey, this is one that changes our Constitution, for example. And then there are two pictures that go with what the ballot measure is about, like I was talking about with the medical marijuana one. Then there are sections, the way it is now, so we tell what the law says now, what this measure would do, a short description of what would change. Then we have a thumbs up symbol, and it says people for this say, and we summarize the arguments about why some people think you should vote for this, and then we have a thumbs down symbol with people against this say this. So we present both sides. Then we have a section that says a yes vote means, and that tells what it would do if you vote yes, and a no vote means whatever. And that's because we found out from self-advocates that even when they read all this information, sometimes it was confusing. They would know how they wanted to vote, but they weren't sure if yes meant what they thought it meant. And that is true for all voters, not just self-advocates. Lots of times the ballot measures are confusing that way. So that's basically our guide.
That's great. It sounds really good. And just to clarify, you stay away from any information that the candidate writes themselves, and you have the League of Women Voters do this so it's not biased.
Well, the League of Women Voters doesn't do it either. I want to be really clear. The candidates present their own information, and the reason why is under FEC law, it's kind of confusing. I don't really want to get into it, but
sure.
You can run afoul of that if you start messing with what the candidates say in their own words. Mm. So we leave it alone.
Okay.
So you can't change what the candidates say, but you can summarize the ballot measures. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I was understanding it. I'd like to open up for any questions that our listeners might have for for Hannah and Julie. So is there any questions from our audience at this time?
Teresa, this is Ursa. Julie and Hannah, I was wondering, this didn't come up. You guys were talking about the letter that you send to candidates to request information. What happens if, say, one candidate for senator responds to your request for information and the other one doesn't? You know, you can't...
Yeah, that's a really good question. And my answer to that is that the league volunteers stay on the candidates, and some candidates just don't respond, and we put that in the league, in the guide. We just say this candidate didn't respond, or this candidate responded too late, or whatever the situation is. By and large, we typically get, I would say, about an 80 or 85% participation rate from candidates. The main thing is starting early. And I know this from working on the guide myself. You have to stay on them and start early. They get lots and lots of requests, especially, you know, candidates for senator and governor and that kind of stuff. You have to stay on them early, stay on their campaigns early, and with repeated requests to get the information.
Is there any audience questions for presenters at this time?
Teresa, it's Nancy.
Sure.
And I just wanted to say I think this is a very cool idea. I wish all the states did this. So I commend you guys for doing this.
Thank you.
Yes, your work is really starting to pay off. Every time I hear about it, you get even clearer and more precise about how you make things accessible. It's really exciting to watch and follow along. Yes.
This is Ursa, sorry.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention to the folks listening that I emailed out with all of the resources a copy of this guide in an email that I sent out last night. But I wanted to mention also that I had several emails bounced back to me. So if you did not receive a list of resources, people can email me to get them.
Oh.
It's Ursa, U-R-S-A, at email.com. Email is all one word. So folks should have a copy of this in their inboxes if they want to check out what the work is that Julie and Hannah have done.
And I just want to put a plug in to say that it continues to improve every election, and the new one will be out in,
oh,
it's already at the printer, so it'll be out very soon, and I would like everyone to look at it, because each step along the way we make some changes and improvements, so look at the latest, it's best.
We are picking up a little bit of background noise from someone. Please make sure that you press *6 to mute your phone if you're not interested in asking a question. Thank you so much. I would like to move along. If we have no other questions at this time, we will try to make time at the end for questions in case you think of something in a little bit. Next, I would like to introduce Sakina McWright, and currently she is the project coordinator for Money Follows the Person Demonstration Project at the Department on Disability Services and Developmental Disabilities Administration in Washington, D.C. Her background includes working with individuals with cognitive disabilities and other disabilities. Hello, Sakina.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I'd like to talk with you a little bit, and if you could tell us a little bit about the guidelines that you have for people and making documents more accessible.
Okay. Well, I should say that, you know, my background, I worked for the National Disability Rights Network, and as part of a committee of folks connected to the PNAs, we put together a fact sheet on how to make documents accessible for people with disabilities. And I also served on a committee through the national or the Federal Traumatic Brain Injury Association's Technical Assistance Center. And we put together a document on how to make meetings accessible. And part of that document included how to write for people with a variety of disabilities, including cognitive disabilities. So, you know, the kinds of things that we looked at in these groups and the kinds of things that I've experienced over the years as I've talked with people who've come to me with various documents going, I have no idea what this document says, and even I had trouble sometimes understanding what they, what the documents were saying. You know, we look at things like, first of all, understanding who your audience is and what the needs of your audience are. And that, you know, that includes getting to know your audience from the beginning of the process. You know, just like Hannah was saying that they do in Oregon. Putting together documents that are clear and concise, using short sentences and short paragraphs that only focus on one idea. When we were writing for the Traumatic Injury Technical Assistance Center, we decided that one of the ways that we were going to put our document together was to use a question and answer format, because we could chunk things together. We could have a question that focused on one idea, and we could have an answer that focused on that particular idea. And so that people could, you know, look at the question and answer and have the information, and they, if they needed to, that they could go back to that question and answer. So we thought that that was a good way of doing it. Looking at things like how the material is presented, you don't want to have like a lot of let's say you have a document where you have writing. You don't want to have underneath that writing, you know, pictures or things that make it more difficult to read the information. I think people really want to understand materials that they're getting, and they want it to be sort of clean, clear, and concise. So having a document that's, you know, the wording is clear, the font is, you know, large, although for some people with cognitive disabilities, they may have other disabilities such as a visual impairment, and a large font is not good, which is often helpful to have materials in alternate formats. So, you know, those are some of the basic guidelines that I've used and have recognized over the years.
Yes, it one thing doesn't fit all, for sure. When people think about documents looking nice, what does that mean? Just give us a little information on that. That means something different to people.
Well, I think, again, you have to go back to who is your audience. You want to make your documents readable for that particular audience. So, you know, somebody might like a document that has, you know, flowers and all kinds of things on it and writing, and it makes it hard to read. Or somebody will have a document, you know, that it's on red paper and the font is actually black and it's hard to read. Well, that might look attractive to some people, but is it readable? Does it meet the needs of your audience? And so I think it's really important to keep in mind who you're writing it for, you know, and what's the purpose of your document. People really want this information. I think voting is incredibly important. We talk a lot about community inclusion, and what's more inclusive than being able to vote and being able to understand the process. So, you know, I think having documents that are very readable for the group that you're working with and for is very important.
When you are thinking about checking your document, your draft document is meeting the needs of your audience, what do you recommend?
Well, I think, as you know, as Hannah said, you want to partner with people who are going to be your audience. You want to look at self-advocacy groups and, you know, check your materials with them to make sure that it's that the documents are meeting their needs. I mean, there, you may find that your audience includes individuals whose first language is not English, and you may have to have a document in another language. So you want to make sure that you're partnering with folks who understand the community, who are part of the community, and can tell you what the community's needs are.
Just to clarify, could you talk a little bit more about the voting information and what you like to share on that and what you don't like, just so we can get a clearer picture of what accessible voting really is to you?
Well, I have a visual impairment, so it's important for me, with my particular visual impairment, to have, you know, the document, first of all, have the paper and the font be contrasting. So I would want an ivory background with black lettering. That's the most helpful for me. And size 18 font is helpful for me because I want to be able to read the document and really understand. I like things that are written in clear, concise language, simple sentences. You know, like many people, I have a lot of information coming at me, so I don't want to have to spend a lot of time sort of figuring out what this document is trying to tell me. But I do want to be informed, and I think that's most people, especially when you're talking about voting. People want to be informed. So I like things that are clear, concise. I like them clean. I don't like a lot of, you know, unnecessary pictures or drawings. If a drawing or a picture is going to help demonstrate a particular idea in a document, I think that's great. That's helpful. But, don't give me pictures and drawings that I don't necessarily need. That's not going to help me understand the idea. But again, I think it's different for every person because every person's a little bit different. And what's helpful to me may not be terribly helpful to other people, which is why you want to have alternative formats.
Yeah. We talk a lot about partnering at the National Technical Assistance Center and was just wondering, have you come across any challenges with trying to partner?
Well, I think it's always hard when you bring people in sort of at the last minute, at sort of the end of the process. I think the challenge is getting people there at the beginning of the process, making sure that they really are partners in the process. You know, getting their feedback as you're going along, really making them feel that they are part of the process. After all, they are your audience. And, you know, oftentimes when you're working with different individuals on a project that can take many forms, you're going to have different opinions. You've got to stay focused on what your goal is, you know, to get a document that's going to be useful for the community. And I think that if, you know, people, in my experience, if they kind of stay focused on the goal, they come out with materials that are useful.
Very good information. I want to open up the conversation with Sakina. Does anyone have questions for Sakina from our audience?
Yeah, this is Ursa. I have one. Sakina, I was wondering what you think are the most important things that authors really need to know when writing material for people with cognitive disabilities. I mean, are there any specific tips you could give?
Well, I think, Ursa, it goes back again to having things like short sentences, short paragraphs that use, you know, common or plain language, sticking to one idea within a paragraph or a sentence, making sure that the documents you know, the font size is a good size for people, you know, having lots of white space so that when a person looks at a document, they're just not hit with, you know, just tons of words and they're all running together. That's not helpful. I think contrast between the color of the paper and the color of the font is good, where the font is, you know, black or dark blue and the paper is ivory or white, and, you know, to avoid kind of paper that has a glare to it. Because, again, I think different people with disabilities have different needs, but I think that, you know, these are sort of the common things that you can look for and work with. And, you know, as you develop your alternative formats, then, you know, you're able to meet a variety of needs. But I think that authors really need to understand that people want to understand this information. They want to have it. Voting is incredibly important, so people really want to participate. So you have to make the language and the structure of the document in a way that, you know, gives people what they need. Because really, you're not writing the document for yourself. You're writing it for other people.
A very important comment there. Thank you so much, Sakina, and we will take questions again at the end if something comes to you. We are going to move along to our next speakers. First, Nancy Ward is the co-director of the National Technical Assistance Center in Voting and Cognitive Access and information coordinator for the Medicaid Reference Desk. Nancy is a national speaker and a self-advocacy leader. Also, Lynn Tamar is president of the ArcLink Incorporated, the organization that hosts the INTAC website, govoter.org, and assists with all of the technology issues. The ArcLink is a nonprofit dedicated to working with individuals with developmental and intellectual disabilities. Nancy and Lynn, we're going to open it up and bounce back and forth between you, if that's okay. First off, Nancy, as a self-advocate, can you share with us what you would like voting information to be like and why it needs to be that way?
Thank you, Teresa. One of the things that's really important to me is, as speakers before us have said, is that it's important to be able to understand what it is that you're voting on. It's very important to me to be an informed voter. One of the ways People First does that is that we have the League of Women Voters come to each time we have an election, and they'll go over the information with us so that's one way we can be informed. But even so that happens, it still can be confusing at your polling place.
Oh.
So what I would like to see happen, but right now they're not allowed to do this, is I wish there was a way that the poll workers would be able to help us understand things. Because you get confused at the polling place.
Are you speaking about the yes and the no means yes, and the yes no means yes, and yes means
yeah,
no?
Yeah, exactly. So it's hard to tell. And even though people go over it with you beforehand, you can forget, and it's still confusing. So one of the things that I think would be helpful is to have a way that we would be able to have that happen at the polling place.
Let me just throw in, this is Lynn, that I'm working with another group, which I've never mentioned to you guys, the Research Alliance on Accessible Voting. And one thing we've been talking a lot about is finding a way to create sample ballots at the local level that people could somehow acquire and fill out and that would be usable at the polling place so that it would be a way of getting around Nancy's questions for at least some people. It doesn't solve all the problems, but we think it would be more, it would be easier to implement because of the problem of poll workers not being allowed to interpret what it says on the ballot. So I just want to throw that in. In terms of sample ballots, encouraging people to use sample ballots and then to develop better sample ballots.
That's good. I wish them well on that for sure. We'll hear more about your work, Lynn, in just a moment. Nancy, is there tips or guidelines for plain language that you would like to mention to our listeners? And it sounds easy, but it isn't. So could you talk about that for a moment?
Sure. One of the places that I would go to is that NTAC has a resource list on our website. And we've written stuff on plain language. And so that would be one place that you could get information.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me add to that, too, in terms of what's on the resource section of the list, that one of the documents, if I don't remember exactly where it's cataloged, but it's on, under plain language, is called Writing Matters, and it's a fairly long, I mean, it's a book, that was written in Alberta by a group that had contracts with the Alberta provincial government and other governments to do all of their governmental work in accessible language. And if you go into that, Chapter 6 is specific to people with intellectual disabilities, although a lot of what they have to say in the other chapters is obviously interesting, too. And we found that in our own work, we had sort of rediscovered most of what's in there, which it sounds like the other speakers have, too. So it's a really good resource, and then there's some shorter resources as well on the site.
That is under the Resource Clearinghouse on the govoter.org website.
GoVoter.
Right.
Yes. And then another place that I think is good to go to is AAPD has a resource list as well where you could get information.
Thank you all for sharing those. I think that looking at multiple materials is very helpful when you're trying to make these important decisions about accessibility of information. Nancy, how important is it that self-advocates are involved in this process?
If the self-advocate is not involved in the process, then how are people supposed to know if they truly understand? So, extremely important. It can't be done without the self-advocate.
So you believe that that partnership is critical to the process of making information accessible?
Yes.
Okay. And one of the things that I know also, just from my experience, is that many times groups will have one self-advocate in the room, and that really is only limiting your information. As we heard before, multiple self-advocates have different issues, so you want to have a variety of representation to assist you with your information. Lynn, we're going to go over to you now.
Yeah, just one other thing.
Oh, sure. Absolutely, Nancy.
when you only have one self-advocate to give you information, what you were just saying is extremely true, very true. But also, it limits the self-advocate's ability to feel comfortable to say how they truly feel.
Very true. Thank you, Nancy, for adding that. Lynn, we'd like to talk with you a little bit about creating print-ready documents on the call. Can you give us some ideas about making the web resources accessible to people?
Okay, well, I mean, there's two pieces. One is sort of web issues, and one is print document issues, and then they overlap. One thing I do want to say right at the beginning is there's a lot of confusion about PDF documents that you read with Acrobat Reader. When people set up websites, they often put up PDF documents because they are hard to change, so they're kind of secure. But depending how they're set up, sometimes screen readers can't read them. And also they're harder to adjust in terms of, you know, printing it out but in larger type and those kinds of things. So those are just things that need to be thought about. And if what you've done is scanned in your text rather than created a PDF file from Word or something like that. But if you've just scanned it in, then it's an image file and a screen reader can't read it at all. And so it really doesn't work. And that's one of the big frustrations, I think, that I find when I'm visiting other people's sites is that they think it's accessible, but they haven't actually tested it. And a lot of what people are saying about clean documents, I think, is really, really true and even more true on the web, where most websites are really cluttered and there's a high priority to put as much information as possible on a page, which makes them very difficult for a lot of people to find what they're looking for. So there's this constant debate about, do you want to, and even in a print document, do you want to be clear and take more pages, which is, can be off-putting, or do you want to cram things together? It makes things look short, but then it gets confusing. And there are lots of opinions about the trade-off, and I think depending on the purpose of the document, that's an area, too, where, you know, a range of self-advocates can help you figure out where the trade-off should be for any particular document. The other thing I wanted to say, and I'm just learning it myself, is that the Acrobat program, that is if the expensive one, the Acrobat Pro, has very, very extensive accessibility features, but they are really hard to use. I'm just learning to use them myself. And some organizations, particularly ACM, which is the Association for Computing Machinery, is requiring that if you submit things to their websites, that it be done in this accessible format. And I think it's worth, for those people on the call who have or could have access to Acrobat Pro, it's really worth learning. And, I mean, I got in trouble because I wanted to submit something to them, and I knew I had to put it in the format, but I didn't know that it was going to take me a long time to learn the format. So I didn't actually have time to submit what I wanted to submit because I couldn't just convert it in one day. You know, there was too much to learn about that. But that, it's a really helpful program. I'm sure that competitors will come out with some that are easier to learn. But right now it's pretty tough.
Like the, you're saying the process that it has to go through to get accessible?
Creating it. It's very helpful. It makes it searchable in different ways. It runs all kinds of readability checks. It, you know, creates a document where you can enlarge the text, change the text, that kind of stuff. Whereas a normal PDF document, it's really hard to do all of those things. So it's a really good program, but it takes some work to learn to use it. So, you know, that's just something I'm learning myself right now. you know, most of the other stuff I would say about print documents, other people have already said. I mean, it came up at a presentation Nancy and I were doing just the other day where somebody said, just please don't use yellow type for anything. And I think that's really common, that yellow type is very hard on the eyes, and if you need high contrast, it doesn't work. When you think about the web, I mean, I think most websites, even websites from disability-related organizations, are not accessible, and they have all kinds of problems. And I don't know how much, you know, people want to hear about that, but let me just say a little bit that, first of all, the navigation system needs to be very consistent and obvious. And if somebody, like, clicks to get to a page, they need to have a way to get back, for instance. And some teeny tiny back link somewhere is really not sufficient. I mean, it needs to be big and it needs to be clear what they're talking about. Clean pages. And anytime there are pictures or images or video, there needs to be text. What you have, what's called alt text, which is kind of behind the image. So if you're just looking at the page, you don't see it. But if a screen reader is reading, when it gets to the picture, it will read the alt text. So say on the Go Voter website, there's a picture of the Go Voter team, and there should be alt text that says, this is a picture of the Go Voter team, and these are the people in the picture, or, you know, something like that. Going the other way, more and more, you can easily closed caption video yourself. You know that there's accessible free programs for doing that. And closed captioning on video is really helpful for lots and lots of people, not just people who can't hear it. Because if it's difficult material or the person is hard to understand or a different accent or whatever, all those things are confusing to everybody and maybe particularly confusing to someone who's already struggling with language because of an intellectual disability. But the only other thing I want to say about text is, you know, there are these readability formulas that pretty much everybody uses that measures sentence length and the number of three-syllable and more words, and so the computation of readability is based on those factors. And it's a really good, quick, and dirty way to look at it, but there are lots and lots of ways in which it doesn't work. There are lots of three-syllable words or more than three-syllable words that people with disabilities are really familiar with, like the word disability. And so when those start to push readability scores up, people shouldn't get scared. It may be fine. And as we all know, writing in very short sentences can be incredibly confusing. So merely shortening sentences doesn't make something readable, and it can, in fact, make things worse. So you really, again, you need that human judge who's reading it saying, you know, is this an improvement? Do I understand this? Or have you now, you know, made it sentences so short that I can't figure out what on earth you're talking about. So I think that's my other main point. And just to remember that adults with cognitive disabilities, if you say that somebody reads at the third grade level, that tells you something about vocabulary and sentence structure and things like that. But an adult who reads at that level has a huge amount more experience than your typical 8 or 9 year old. And so their background knowledge is really different. So, again, you need to, you know, be talking to the people, particularly in something like voting, where, you know, people who are interested in voting have a lot of knowledge that a third grader wouldn't have. And so you don't, you want to be careful not to just sort of make it babyish, but to actually just make it accessible.
So making it clearer without assuming that they don't understand.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, like most voters actually don't understand some key things, and that's not a disability issue. Like they don't know what people with certain jobs can actually do. So, you know, you vote, somebody's running for their township treasurer, but they're running on right-to-life issues. It has nothing to do with the job as treasurer. Now, you may still want to know how they stand on right-to-life, but you also need to know that the treasurer doesn't have any more say about that than anybody else. And so those things I can see explaining. But other things, you know, people know. Or, you know, you might want to have a glossary where people could look up certain terms but not go on, not just assume people don't know them, like
right.
poll worker or something like that, which is a technical term. I don't think many 8-year-olds know what a poll worker is. But it may be your audience does. And we also use glossaries really a lot. You don't want to have people having to look up every other word because you'll lose them. I mean, it's just too hard to read that way. If any of you have like tried to read in a foreign language and have to look up a whole lot of words, you know, you just lose interest. But you know, for some words that are very technical and you kind of have to use them, then it's good to define them somewhere else and not sort of go on to a tangent in the middle of your paragraph.
Just to go back a little bit, and let's talk a little bit more about the partnering on this information. Could you talk to us a little bit more about the partnering roles that people have had with working with you on your accessible information?
Well, the main thing that we do, and Nancy,
I also add about when you're done something.
Absolutely.
No, go ahead first while you've got it in mind.
Okay. Well, what I think is important about the partnering that I have with Lynn or with Hannah, whichever the case may be, is that both of them understand that there's words that I don't understand. So they're going to help me understand that. And I don't have to be afraid to ask that question. There's a trust developed between us. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, that was in my notes, too, and sort of echoing what other people said about being there from the beginning. I mean, part of that is also building a relationship of mutual trust and really mutual support, that you're not sort of handing, like if you develop a document, you don't just sort of hand it to someone for editing. I mean, it should be more like a joint project, not like, well, you fix it, but you're not really part of it. And I'd say, I mean, the big problem is that it's time-consuming. And, you know, I think I know in our work on the Medicaid Reference Desk, I mean, I'm dealing with it right now, that I need to get updated information onto our website fast. And yet this process isn't fast. So, you know, I think you need to talk enough with each other and kind of figure out how you're going to deal with problems like deadlines. Because, you know, it's easy if I put up, one of my worries is if I put up a halfway measure, which I'm going to do, I mean, I've been doing it today, of putting up stuff I wrote that Nancy hasn't reviewed yet. The troublesome part to me is that I can't somehow get in my head that I'm done. This is a temporary measure, and that's all, and it has to be fixed. So I want our information to be updated, but part two has to happen as well. And I think what happens really often is part two doesn't happen because you move on to other things. So it takes a real commitment.
And
a partner like Nancy who will bug me.
And I also think, and can you guys hear me still?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I wasn't sure if I was on mute or not.
Go ahead.
The other part of this is that with the technology that you have now, there's different ways that you can do this. To go over stuff, both Hannah, Lynn, and I have found using GoToMeeting really helps, because you can put whatever you're going over up on the screen. So, you know, they can get on my computer, and then we can go over stuff. Even though Hannah lives in Oregon, Lynn lives in Michigan, and I live in Oklahoma, we can still get on each other's computers. And that makes a huge difference in being able to partner, is to have that kind of accessibility. So I think technology plays a huge part in partnering.
Thank you. Thank you both for going through that process with us. We do experience all kinds of different partnerships, and it's good to be open to that. And I think the thing that's important about it, too, that kind of came up for me when I was listening, was that it's an established partnership. It's something that happens before you need it, so that you can know how best to access that person if you do have a timeline. Does the person have a way to get the information quickly, either through, and it doesn't have to always be computers, it could be through faxing or something, so that people could get the information, go over it with you while you're on a phone, even if they don't have a computer. But to have an established relationship where you can call them and say, this is something that is happening right now, I need you to be able to look this over and talk to me about it before I send it out. And I think that that's the hardest thing, is that people wait till it's due or have things happen to them in crisis where they need it and they can't get access to the person. And if you have an established way of doing that, then the person can be accessible to you. You just need to know how to work together ahead of time.
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to open up the phone for questions for our speakers. Nancy and Lynn, anyone have a question? Okay. We now have all of these individuals available to anyone on the phone. If you have a question for one of our previous speakers, we'd be more than happy to have you ask your questions at this time. Does any of our speakers have anything that they would like to add that has come to them after they presented? Anything come up for any of our panelists that you would like to add?
Hello?
Well, if they're trying to ask a question, remember to unmute your phone. *6 unmutes.
Yes. Did someone
hear me? Hello, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi there. This is Kate Georgian-Seipel from the Disability Law and Advocacy Center in Tennessee. And I just had a question about offering documents that are more accessible, because so much of what we produce can tend to have highly legal, legally-based information. And so what is the response to offering two documents that have the same information, one that is, full legal jargon, and then one that is an accessible format? Is that an offensive route to take?
Teresa, could I answer that?
Absolutely, Nancy.
Okay. When I'm originally from Nebraska, and Nebraska's PNA did the support for people first, and because that was very important to us, what we did is we took the technical terms and left them in there, but in parentheses put what it meant, you know, in easy to understand language. So it's kind of the same idea that you were talking about, Kate, but it's in one document.
Although I think, you know, on the Medicaid Reference Desk, which is the project that Nancy and I work together on the most, you know, we've had this debate. Nancy's housed, you know, at the Oklahoma Disability Law Center. And so there were real debates because the Medicaid law is so technical and difficult to understand and just large. And when we were boiling it down to try to make it accessible, it, you know, we lose the nuances. We don't, for instance, I was just writing some stuff on Alabama that, in fact, it covers doctor visits, but it only covers 14 doctor visits a year, except under certain circumstances and blah, blah, blah. And we ended up, what we do at this time is we have one main document, which is the accessible version. And
Lynn, are you there?
Yeah. Can't hear me?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't know what that was.
Okay. Am I okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. What we try to do is provide links to the actual document, or documents in the case of Medicaid. We've had debates about putting the legal documents available for download. At this point, with respect to Medicaid law, that's too massive. You know, it's just enormous amounts of material, and categorizing it and so forth is beyond us. But we're trying to increase our links to official documents. Some of them are the actual laws, and some are state policy statements. But we had talked about sort of having two versions on the site, and we decided, kind of echoing what other people have said, that let's stay true to what the main goal of the site is. And let's make documents that are appropriate to that goal. And then let's give people access to ways to get more. I don't know if that... And also then to say in as many places as we can that this is not the law. This is to help you talk to people about this law, but it isn't the law itself. So this is going to help you understand enough to ask good questions.
Kate, this is Ursa. You know, it's interesting. I was talking, I don't know if Julie's still on the phone, but I was talking to Julie before this call. You know, she's the one who works on the Easy Voters Guide here in Oregon. And she was telling me this great story, Julie, about how you would put some of those out in the lobby of your office, and you noticed that the lawyers were taking them.
Yeah, the Easy Voter Guide, it's pretty popular. And I was just thinking that it's been something that I've been working with my agency about. You know, it benefits everybody to have things in simple language. And by simple, I don't mean third grade level necessarily. I mean clear and concise, and so it's a tough thing to do. It really is. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of practice. I've worked on a few things that some of the attorneys in my office have written, trying to make them a little bit more accessible to just the general public, and it's hard. It takes time, but I think it's so worth it because I think everybody benefits from it.
Yeah, I will completely confess to have used it myself many, many times because I'll sit down with my official voter's guide, and there will be, you know, 20 pages about one ballot measure, and I finally am just like, I have no idea what these people are talking about.
Yeah.
And I found that summing something up in two or three sentences benefits everybody. So, I mean, for those folks who are wondering if offering two versions might be insulting to some of their clients, I would say as long as people are getting the information they need, then your intent is good. You know,
your goal is to give people information, you're doing that successfully. Great job.
You know, and I think it's a balance. And you know, as attorneys, we're anything we're sending out to as a general brochure, we're not intending it to be in lieu of advice in a specific factual situation, of course. So I think that, you know, you can rest assured that you can give the information that's important for someone to know without going into every little detail and exception. And, you know, I think you really can. It's a balancing act and a judgment call each and every time for sure, but I would encourage you to do it.
I just wanted to throw in something else, which is that at the moment, a lot of the most interesting work, I think, on accessible language is happening in the healthcare field, where people are trying to make patient information accessible. So, you know, if you get a diagnosis of diabetes and your doctor hands you a brochure, to make those brochures as fully accessible as possible. And so if you're sort of interested in conveying technical information in an accessible format, right now the people who are working on it are definitely the healthcare professionals. So I'm just throwing that out. It's an interesting fact.
And one of the things, this is Nancy, that I also think that's been true since we started the desk is that, I know this is going to sound like a cliche, but where you talk about nothing about us without us, that truly has been the case. I've been included since the very beginning.
Right. Thank you all for your comments on that question. I also feel that it's always good to have someone on your team that can help you translate information right from the beginning. Anytime, you know, have someone that you can call on to help you do that. When we did items here in Arizona, we would call it the user-friendly version of the statement by our, you know, whoever it was that we were trying to inform about their comments or something, and then we would make this user-friendly version is available, prepared by so-and-so and the phone number in case people had questions. But what we found was that the attorneys and other individuals in different groups were able to explain things because people had the user-friendly version of things for different meetings and committees where the public was involved. So it does make it worthwhile to have both versions available to you so that you can get the most educated individuals as possible. Is there any other questions for our panelists at this time? And we're opening up to all panelists as well if you would like to add comments. Well, hearing none, I'd like to thank you all for attending the National Technical Assistance Center on Voting and Cognitive Access discussion on accessible voting materials. There are extensive information on our clearinghouse on the GoVoter website, and you also have the access to any of us that you have talked to today. We will have our information on the website as well in case you have further questions later. Thank you so much for making time for the call, and be looking out for the next opportunities on the website. Thank you.